You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, at Columbia University in New York City, students protest against artificial intelligence, and a math professor talks about what AI and math have in common, if anything. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. Help us do the math. If you appreciate what you're hearing, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and click on a subscribe button. We'll be most grateful. Now, the news with Kylie Wong.
A group of economists has unveiled a blueprint to tackle inequality and climate change at once. According to the World Inequality Lab, humanity can reduce inequality, boost living standards, and limit global warming to under 2 degrees this century, simultaneously. Their plan proposes major wealth taxes, shorter working hours, lower red meat consumption, and greater investment in education and healthcare. Most people's incomes would rise and environmental pressures decline. Political will, not technical feasibility, is the real challenge, the plan says. There's a huge cultural, intellectual, political battle that is going on, says Thomas Piketty, co-director of the World Inequality Lab Report. 7 northeastern U.S. states have filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over its attempt to get a major offshore wind energy project canceled. The federal government would pay nearly $1 billion to French energy company Total Energies to abandon 2 wind projects while redirecting investment towards oil and gas projects. Led by New York Attorney General Letitia James, the states argue the agreement is illegal, harms clean energy goals, threatens union jobs, and misuses taxpayer funds. We are fighting back to stop this illegal agreement that threatens to erase over 1,000 union jobs and cheat millions of New Yorkers out of clean, affordable energy, said James. Thousands have fled southern Lebanon after Israel ordered the evacuation of 9 villages and launched a new wave of airstrikes. The attacks came one day after Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah rejected a proposed ceasefire, saying it failed to ensure complete Israeli withdrawal from Lebanese territory. Almost 4,000 have been killed and over 11,000 injured since Israel's attack on Lebanon began on March 2nd. Lebanon can no longer be a field for wars fought for others, nor can the south of Lebanon and its people continue to pay the price for decisions they did not make, said Nawaf Salam, the Lebanese prime minister. As the former presiding judge of the International Court of Justice, Salam could stress the unlawful basis of Israel's war on Lebanon and its expanding occupation of Lebanese territory. He does not. While war-driven oil shocks threaten to drive up inflation and household expenses, critics say Canada has the tools to shield consumers and make oil companies pay their share. Economist Jim Stanford contends that Canada, which produces more oil than it consumes, should not experience the full effects of global supply disruptions. Stanford argues that governments should limit the impact of higher oil prices by regulating domestic oil prices and imposing windfall taxes on price-gouging oil companies. Revenue from such taxes, Stanford suggests, could be directed towards consumer rebates and investments in renewable energy infrastructure. Hundreds of Hamilton residents rallied outside City Hall last week to oppose a proposed AI data center on the city's waterfront, raising concerns about energy use, water consumption, and a lack of public consultation. The project is part of Slate Asset Management's broader Steelport initiative, which envisions an AI, advanced manufacturing, and clean infrastructure hub on Hamilton's harborfront. Environmental advocates and local residents have urged the city to conduct a thorough review before approving the plan. Questions about the project's ultimate size and environmental footprint remain to be answered, critics say. More about AI in today's edition of the GPM. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Kylie. So, Back in mid-May, I spent a week in New York City attending the 21st session of the United Nations Forum on Forests. You heard voices from that a few GPMs ago. Taking a break from forest talk, I took the subway across to Brooklyn to speak with Professor Ervand Abrahamian about Iran. The next day, I headed down to Cooper Square in NoHo, not Soho, NoHo, to speak with Nikhil Pal Singh about Donald Trump's homeland empire. Those interviews have also been posted here. I also headed over to Columbia University in the heart of West Harlem to speak about AI with math professor and old colleague Michael Harris. We'll listen to my exchange with Michael in a moment. First, sounds outside Columbia in front of the heavily guarded gates of one of America's most hallowed halls at Broadway and West 116th Street. Columbia University students were doing what students are famous for, protesting their beef. At Columbia's imminent graduation ceremony, the names of graduating students would be announced not by the university rector, not by the beetle, but by an AI-generated voice. Columbia students had other bones to chew.
One, no AI voice at graduation. Woo! Two, no partnership with Claude or Chat. Woo! Three, cancel the AI minor and cancel the AI masters. Woo! And four, disclose how much money Columbia receives from Anthropic and OpenAI. AI voice at graduation.
AI voice at graduation.
That is an abomination.
That is an abomination.
AI voice at graduation.
AI voice at graduation.
That is an abomination.
That is an abomination.
That is an abomination.
That is an abomination.
AI voice at graduation.
Graduation.
Fun grad students, fuck AI.
Fun grad students, fuck AI.
Don't let education die.
Don't let education die.
Fun grad students, fuck AI.
Fun grad students, fuck AI.
So why are you here?
I'm here because I wrote an op-ed 2 months ago in the Columbia Spectator after my professor revised his class to incorporate AI in a mandatory way so that you could not pass the class without AI. And I was so angry about that that I wrote an op-ed, and it's catalyzed all sorts of discussion on campus. There's now a working group among professors who are trying to revise the AI policy to make it stricter, which I'm very happy to hear about, but that's only a very small fraction of even the Columbia College, like, liberal arts community. Many people are just embracing AI in a very unthinking way. So I organized this with some friends to try to say we should actually deliberate before we mindlessly accept a technology that does so much more harm than good.
What would be a more thinking way to incorporate AI into academia?
I think we should look to the past 100 years. We should look at the Cold War and how we embraced nuclear weapons because we thought that they were inevitable. There's something called, a professor who's going to speak today, she talks about the myth of inevitability, how we tell ourselves that a certain technology is the future and therefore we will fall behind if we don't embrace it. And it just becomes a completely self-fulfilling prophecy because then we embrace it because we think we have to embrace it and then we've embraced it. And that almost led us to blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons during the Cold War, and I don't want us to make the same mistake.
This is the technological imperative.
Yes, exactly. Hans Jonas, do you like Hans Jonas?
I've heard the name.
Okay, yeah. I read him over the summer. That's so awesome. I don't know many of the people who are into him because he feels like he has a small audience. But yeah, exactly. He writes about how we should develop technology only when we actually have an explicit use for it. And I'm so tired of that at Columbia. We invest in AI and then we say, oh, we can use this to do good things like education or healthcare. But those same people who make those arguments never cared about education or healthcare in the first place. It feels like we just are following the money, we're following Silicon Valley. Can I add one more thing also?
Sure.
The real catalyst for this specific protest is that 1 week ago, we all got an email from the administration announcing Claude for Education. So it's a partnership that's making Claude, as well as two other AI chatbots completely free to all university affiliates. That's an incredible amount of money for the university to be spending on us and encouraging us to use AI. And I just want to know how much money they're A, receiving from Silicon Valley to do this, and B, spending on it for themselves for us to have it when we don't even need this technology to educate ourselves.
Can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and where you are.
Yes, my name is Grace Coste, K-A-S-T-E. I'm a senior at Columbia studying history and economics. I'm with this whole big group of people who care about this, which is really lovely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Grace Coste also plays double bass. She, her friend Hannah, an English senior and banjo player, and a guy named Ted Schmiedler, an accordion player, performed anti-AI songs adapted from 60s folk classics.
'Technology is almost a religion. It's a substitute, possibly, for the established state religion that we lack. And our politicians and pundits constantly hasten to proclaim their faith in this religion, in the power of technology to ease our lives. Even those who criticize some aspect of technology too often are quick to stipulate that they too worship at the altar. Oh, don't get me wrong, they say. Of course I believe in technology too. I'm an enthusiastic user. Here we are, I'm preaching to a small and brave group of apostates. Thank you for dissenting from our universal public religion. Because artificial intelligence and chatbots and large language models have gravely disrupted this pious American consensus. Unlike past innovations, the harms and the damage that they have done to society were immediately apparent, and especially the harms to education. They were crystal clear from the outset, while the benefits have remained notional and vague. Nevertheless, here at Columbia, we have many high priests, many true believers in this religion of technology. The Center for Teaching and Learning has positioned itself right from ever since it opened as a source of uncritical boosterism for every technological initiative that comes along in pedagogy, and AI is no exception.
Shame!
The School of Engineering, of course, is a redoubt of technophiles. Its leader, Shifu Chang, constantly speaks of engineering for humanity, but this appears to be little more than a slogan. He speaks of the need for guardrails without ever specifying what those might be. And parenthetically, Dean Chang mentioned the other day that a 10-page research paper submitted to an AI journal now is required to contain half a page of commentary on the ethical issues and unforeseen consequences raised by the new technology. Well, I wonder what half page of the paper is written by AI. Then there is Dean Amy Hungerford. Her tenure as Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences has left little doubt that she is more preoccupied with maximizing revenue than she is with the welfare of her faculty and students. She bubbles over with enthusiasm, measured enthusiasm to be sure, but still enthusiasm about AI initiatives. A strategic visioning plan that she circulated last year declares her ambition to position Columbia as a leader in preparing students for an AI-saturated world, which is more than she has ever said about the welfare of the doctoral students under her purview.
Shame!
Finally, Columbia's Board of Trustees.
Boo!
Make it no secret that they applaud AI initiatives, and in fact, using their power of self-perpetuation, They wish to appoint new trustees with AI expertise.
Shame!
By the way, speaking of self-perpetuation, this is a bit of a non sequitur. Grace mentioned that AI has a capacity of self-perpetuation. So I thought, well, what does she actually mean by that? And then it occurred to me, try asking AI sometime for its own opinion about AI. I was wondering the other day, so what if large language models had existed during the pandemic? You know what would have happened. Every student sitting on Zoom would have ported their class discussion directly to a chatbot, which would have prompted him or her for clever things to say. But when I asked AI what would have happened, this is the response I got. If large language models had existed during COVID, they could have significantly aided in research and communication, helping to design vaccines and disseminate information quickly. Their capabilities in processing data and generating insights would have been invaluable in addressing the pandemic's challenges. Just the kind of bland, boosterish response you would expect from AI.
Jane!
Of course, it's true, the world is becoming AI saturated, and we need to respond to it. We can't pretend it's not happening. But the not very... Yeah.
Woo! Woo!
We have another AI detractor here, or maybe someone who needs to enter the gates. The not very critical embrace of AI is the wrong approach. It's hard not to notice the dollar signs lighting up in the eyes of our top administrators, their unstated but obvious belief that AI will somehow become a gusher of money, relieving the university's financial ills.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Richard John. I teach at Columbia in history in the PhD program in communications. And I also teach in the core curriculum.
And why are you here?
Some of my students were organizing the protest, and I was here to cheer them on and to get more information about AI and how we're thinking about the role of AI in liberal arts, which is an important question that I'm glad the students as well as faculty members are addressing.
And they're a big issue. I mean, there are numerous big issues, but one is that the names of the graduates, the upcoming graduation, convocation ceremony at Columbia University, their names are going to be announced by AI.
Right. Well, that's new, and it's something that in the past we've had faculty members announce the names, and it was an opportunity to learn about different cultures and to learn about different kind of cultural modes, and that's unfortunate that we're not doing that this year.
What's your area of history?
American history, history of technology, business, political economy.
Is AI inevitable, quote unquote?
Well, nothing's inevitable. AI is here. Nothing's inevitable. AI is here, and it will be used. It's being used in many humanistic fields as well as in scientific fields. But there's a question about how AI is going to be rolled out in classrooms, and particularly discussion classrooms, how it's going to be used in conjunction with, let's say, traditional assignments, and how, say, in a setting like commencement, we will be shifting from the human-human interaction to a machine-human interaction. And those are all questions that I'm very grateful that the students are raising, because it's a discussion we should be having.
And are you using AI in your scholarship and in your classroom?
I use AI in my scholarship. I do not yet use it in the classroom. I don't have plans to, but I might. It's a tool in the same way that the personal computer was a tool, and in the same way, say, that typewriter was a tool. So it's, and the students are not opposed to expertise. They're not opposed to they're using various modern devices. It's really a question about what education is, what the liberal arts are, and how the university as an institution is going to adjust to the current challenges and opportunities posed by big corporations that see opportunities in partnering with universities.
Do you feel under pressure to incorporate AI?
No, not at all. The core, in fact, I'm on the AI committee for the core, we're quite concerned about it. I have faculty members who are very enthusiastic. There are possibilities. It's very useful for literature reviews. We will figure out as the years go by how to best use it, but I certainly am disturbed by the reports of students using AI to come up with written assignments, even prompts, responses to faculty prompts. That undermines, as the students said so well here today, that undermines the humanities in the liberal arts. And that's a value I think that's extremely important for us to uphold at this moment, disjuncture in time.
The essence of education is critical independent thought.
Yeah, including critical independent thought about AI.
But it would seem that AI is like the antithesis of
anytime you use Google, anytime you are interacting with online, we are interacting with huge corporations that are using a lot of energy. So it's not something that's entirely new, but it's something that we need to think about. And when we think about it, young people, the faculty, people like yourself, will be better able to make solid, well-informed decisions.
What does history teach us about the incorporation and the adoption of new technologies?
It can be shaped by popular protest. It can be shaped by business imperatives. Is there anything inevitable about new technology? No. New technology does have it has a tendency to insinuate itself, and that can be good. A lot of world we live in today would have been inconceivable without the technologies established between, or the innovations established in the 1880s and the 1940s. Since the 1940s, in many realms, innovations have been less significant. But we live in a world that's been fundamentally shaped by Second Industrial Revolution. Is AI part of that? Is it a new revolution? Those are questions that we'll ponder in the days and years to come.
Thank you so much.
Okay, good. Good luck.
Richard John is a history professor at Columbia University. Before him, you heard Michael Thaddeus, a professor of mathematics and the vice president of the Columbia chapter of the American Association of University Professors. We'll return to anti-AI agitation at Columbia University in a moment. I did manage to enter the Columbia campus past steadfastly guarded iron gates with the aid of a QR code across Columbia's beautiful campus in the heart of African-American Harlem. I sat down with a mathematician named Michael Harris. Michael and I know each other from the late 1980s. I had gone down to Nicaragua with a group called Science for the People that Michael was helping lead. Today, Michael is an accomplished mathematician at Columbia, specializing in number theory. Last time he and I sat down was in Leiden in the Netherlands in September 2025 at a computer science mathematics conference. Among the outcomes of that gathering, a declaration on the ethical principles of artificial intelligence. The Leiden Declaration, as it's called, will be publicly revealed in July. Stay tuned. On other matters, Michael Harris and I spoke at depth. I don't know if you feel qualified to answer this question, but I've been pondering this as a biologist. Mm-hmm. Is it theoretically possible for artificial intelligence to mimic or to rival or become equivalent to human biological intelligence? Because biological intelligence, if one presumes that there's nothing metaphysical mm-hmm. that enters into human intelligence, we can debate this, let's not. But, you know, setting aside the idea that there is a soul or there is a mm-hmm. spirit, that the human mind, human intelligence is purely neurochemical. Mm-hmm. It's just the sum of a fantastic number of electrical and chemical events that take place in the brain. And my question is there anything about human intelligence, if we understand it simply in that way, there's nothing metaphysical about it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing magical or metaphysical. It's just purely neurochemical. Is there anything about that artificial intelligence can't mimic?
Well, you know, that is a very long philosophical debate, and I don't think it's close to being settled. What I can say is that in my impression of the reigning attitude in Silicon Valley is starting from the points you made in materialist metaphysics, concluding that the neural networks that are the basis of artificial intelligence are not just analogous to, not just metaphors for, but are precisely the same thing as the processes of human intelligence.
And that's what people in Silicon Valley say.
There's a very nice article that probably hasn't been got enough attention outside by Jaron Lanier, who is also heavily involved in the technology, but he's a contrarian. He's written a number of books with a title like "You Are Not a Gadget," that definitely he disagrees with this perspective. He has an article about zombies, and in which he states that most of the people in Silicon Valley are convinced that they and you are zombies. That is to say, just machines with nothing inside, and you know they can be. In other words, they can be reproduced by artificial means as soon as the technology gets to that point. And they count the number of neurons and the number of connections, and they say once we get to so many connections and so many operations, then we will have reproduced everything worth saving in human intelligence, and but much faster and somewhat with fewer mistakes. And you know, there are people who sincerely believe, people in the industry who sincerely believe that their mission are living at this time is to bring into being the successor to human intelligence, which is, you know, that's a transhumanism, and there are all kinds of disadvantages and flaws with human intelligence, and maybe the worst thing is that it is, let's say it's the worst, you know, that it is finite. And on the other hand, there's another concern, which is maybe more something they share with their corporate customers, which is that humans think for themselves. You know, may not, you know, they take breaks, they go on strike, they want health care. You know, so all these
are all consequences, natural consequences of, one might argue, the purely physical, neurochemical nature of human intelligence, that it's incredibly diverse, it's incredibly versatile, it can engage in almost any kind of degree of thought, and you can have contradictory ideas that are in competition, and it's all purely a function of all this fantastic number of neurochemical connections. And at some point, and even a conscience, and at some point we can mimic this through artificial intelligence.
Well, you know, again, this raises the question of what's the point of human beings in the first place. But if you ask that, you know, if you are inclined to see human beings as a beta version of intelligence, then you're going to imagine the arc of history bending in a certain direction. But you can take it from the other perspective. You know, what is human flourishing? What is that consist in? You know, if this is a value, why should there be a value? And as far as mathematics is concerned, the vision of a machine replacing human mathematicians is inconsistent with the vision of mathematics as a social activity, as a community, as a living community.
Does this idea exist there, that mathematics is a living kind of?
That's what mathematicians spontaneously think. The term, the quotation that comes repeatedly. And by the way, there was a very good article about this not so long ago on the Substack newsletter of David Bessis, B-E-S-S-I-S, who wrote a book in French called Mathematica that's been translated into English. The quotations that come back are that the purpose of mathematics is not to produce something or other, but to develop human understanding. Now, you know, this is what I'm writing about, because it's an elusive notion, because when you ask human understanding of what, well, it's human understanding of mathematics. So it sounds kind of circular, but except it's a genuine historical social community. It's something that has been going on that people do, and rather than try to look for a justification, you know, looking for a justification for human mathematics is very close to looking for a justification for the existence of human beings in the first place.
And there's an interesting idea that what makes humans, the human mind, unique is that it can understand itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, no matter how complex a mathematical formula is or an intelligence system, an artificial intelligence system, it's not capable of understanding itself like the human mind is. Of course, I know nothing about these kinds of things. I'm just talking. Talking off the top of my head.
If you talk to people in the industry, they will tell you that they're working on that.